Thanks, everyone. Always nice to be back. Once upon a time when we were preparing for this talk, the materials had to be submitted back in October. You may not know this, but your materials have been hand calligraphied by monks working from a remote abbey in Saskatchewan. So you think it would just be as simple as going to Kinko's a week or so before the Institute, but there's really much more involved in doing that, plus all the thumb drives who can keep it all straight. So I had to submit materials before Thanksgiving in advance of this event, crossing my fingers that Congress was going to do what it had been doing very successfully for the 10 months before, and that was absolutely nothing. And then, of course, Congress imposes its self-imposed deadline, and we've got to get this done by the end of the year, and the president on December 22nd actually signs some legislation that you might have heard about, instantly rendering the 30-plus pages of materials that I'd prepared for you of academic interest only, which academic interest is a bit of an oxymoron, I'll confess. So I begged, pleaded, borrowed, did whatever I had to do, cashed in a few favors, performed a few other favors and the like to be able to ask if I could submit some addendum materials. And through the great patience and wonderful logistics of everybody involved in the conference, the first set of materials that you have behind the tab, if you're still working with the old-fashioned kind, is this 50-page summary that I prepared called Understanding the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, subtitled How I Spent the Week Between Christmas and New Year's, which was the most welcome diversion because the in-laws were visiting for the entire time. So everybody enjoyed the Christmas vacation as I was knee-deep in statute and they were knee-deep in grandchildren, and I got the better end of that deal. So what I tried to do here in the 50 pages was, under the assumption you're not much into reading 530 pages of legislation, try to give you the basic skinny on what's going on. Of course, this legislation has been out for, what, 6-7 weeks now, and so you've already probably given some preliminary thought to the big picture items. But we'll talk about a few of the technical details because it's surprising how many people think some things are in the bill which are not. This is largely a product of the fact that the House bill, which had come out first, garnered a lot of press attention with some of its details, only to have the Senate later on say, no, you were just kidding, right? And not include those provisions in the final bill. So you may be, and some of your clients may still be, under the misperception that there are things in the bill which are not in the final act, as well as maybe talking about some of the preliminary consensus that is starting to build about how we're supposed to be planning with this big beast right now. And just to make sure that we don't run out of time, because I understand 4:40 is a hard stop, not just because I'm a state employee, but because there's an open bar. So if I'm not done at 4:30, you're just going to get up and go anyway. Hell, this is Oregon. You're going to leave at 4:20. But when, I know we got to stop at that particular time, and I'll make sure that we do that. And just so we are able to do that, let me point out that in the first set of materials, beginning at or around, where is that? Page 33 of the Understanding the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is where the federal wealth transfer tax aspects of the act are talked about. And of course, for all of the nervousness that we had about the possible repeal or a phased-in repeal of the estate and generation skipping transfer tax, as had been teased to us for much of the spring and fall, it turned out to be much ado about nothing, much like Star Wars Episode 8. Ultimately, we still have an estate and generation skipping transfer tax along with the gift tax that we know. It's still at a 40% rate. The only thing that's different, of course, is that we have doubled the exemption, but it's not quite doubling the exemption. We knew coming into this year that had Congress done nothing, the exemption amount was going to be $5.6 million. But because, and finally, it was going to be 5.6 instead of 5.49, which makes it look like we're engaged in Walmart pricing with our exemptions. It was a nice, easy number that most of us could double in our heads or with the assistance of an abacus or calculator when talking with a married couple. But remember, the way that we've implemented this is to say, well, the basic exclusion amount goes from $5 million to $10 million adjusted for inflation, but you're supposed to pretend as though the code has always provided for a $10 million basic exclusion as of 2011 and do your inflation adjustments, but you're supposed to use a different indexing or inflation adjustment mechanism than what had been previously used because that exemption was just skyrocketing way too fast. And so when you run the numbers it's not 11.2 as the new exemption amount. Everybody's expecting, and we're just waiting for Treasury to ultimately finally confirm, and someday they will, and that someday might be in November, but it will happen, that the exemption amount is $11.18 million per person. That is, for married couples, $22.36 million. That made it much easier to talk about with your clients and not alienating them at all. So, almost $11.2 million per person. That has a pretty profound effect on a decent chunk of your client base, because with the stroke of a pen, Congress has rendered a fair number of your clients into statutory losers. They are failures like the rest of us. Finally, our clients are no better than we are. We can talk to them with some degree of confidence because they're po-folk too. What do you do now? Well, one thing, change your business card, because your business card says high net worth individuals. Cross out the GH and put in a comma. So when the $5 million married couple comes into your office, you still say, "Hi, net worth, I'm happy to work with you." But the nice thing about having an $11.2 million exclusion is, for a good chunk of your client base, when it comes to estate and gift tax planning, there's no way you can F this up, all right? Suppose you're working with a married couple that between the two of them has maybe $8 million. 10 years ago, you would have been like, "Oh, well, we got to be careful how we do this. They got tax-sensitive issues." Now, you're like, what does it matter? Because even if you're completely asleep at the wheel on the death of the first spouse, the surviving spouse has an 11.18 and growing inflation-adjusted exclusion amount that's in play. Oh, but their $8 million could outpace that, and they could suddenly have $13 or $15 million. Yeah. As if you're not familiar with the concept of inertia, right? Everybody suddenly starts making their wealth in their 70s. That's not really how it works. So once a loser, always a loser, and you've just been kind of tagged that way now, right? And of course, everybody instantly pops in with, "Well, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this inflation-adjusted exclusion amount is only in play through 2025. If Congress does nothing come 2026, we go back to a $5 million as adjusted for inflation exclusion." And there comes that word clawback into our vocabulary and within the specter of fear. I thought we dealt with this the last time. Clawback is a myth. Clawback will not happen. And if you're worried that somehow the statute doesn't quite give you the comfort that you want because you're not very good at reading the statute, fine. Think in your history, one time in our history, the exclusion amount has gone down. That was in 2011 when it went from infinity to $5 million. Right? But we didn't even really know that that was the case because we spent much of that year of infinity always thinking that Congress was going to retroactively do something, and few of our clients were taking us up on the advice to hurry up and die already. So chances are exclusion amounts tend not to go down, and how many times do we have to go down this road before we start saying you're the boy who cried wolf here? There's neither going to be clawback nor a reduction in the exemption amount that's probably going to happen. Probably, although we don't know for sure. Point is, if I'm working with the $8 million couple now, I'm not really concerned about transfer taxes, and it really is exclusively an income tax basis game. So what I've tried to do in the materials here, and particularly with working with married couples, starting on page 34, is to talk about how you might go about doing planning in a post-tax reform world. That is, if you have a married couple that comes into your office that has a combined net worth of less than one basic exclusion amount, $11.18 million, pages 34 and 35 and 36 and even on to the top of page 37 talk about how you could plan for them to try to maximize the step up in basis so that everything gets a step up in basis on the death of the surviving spouse, and suggest some basic strategies that you could be using there. It's probably what you were already doing with your $3 and $4 million couples. You're just now doing it with the $8, $9, and $10 million couples as well. Page 37 then starts talking about if you have clients that come in with a $15 million estate, that is more than one basic exclusion, but less than two basic exclusions. Well, now I got to do something, because if the surviving spouse dies with only an $11.18 million exclusion and the first spouse left everything to the surviving spouse, or everything is wholly revocable in the surviving spouse's rev trust, well, oops, I'm going to have some estate tax liability that's there. And so bucket two, as it's talked about in the materials, talks about how you make the choice between portability planning and traditional credit shelter trust planning, with some ideas that are probably very familiar to you now about how you go about making the decision between which of those is the best option and how to keep everything flexible if you don't exactly know which one's going to be best in that particular situation. Then page 40 of the materials talks about how whales are still whales even after this act. I don't care how much the AMA adjusts the BMI index number, I'm always going to be obese. And so if I am a whale, I still have to be somewhat concerned about transfer tax planning. And it talks about how still doing grits and grats and gruts and clats and cruts and nimcruts and shark fin clats and all these other fancy little things that we continue to do, you would still go ahead and use. You can still use valuation discounts. You got to balance it against the income tax limitations of valuation discounts when it comes time for the step up in basis. Some of that stuff is talked about there on page 40. So again, from a transfer tax perspective, not a whole lot has changed other than the fact that the taxable estate has truly become the endangered species. And so income tax planning becomes something that's even more important for most of our clients. That might make some of the earlier materials a little bit more relevant to your practice than what you may have thought had been the case. Let's go back in the materials, if we could, to page 3 and get started with the individual income tax provisions by looking at the bottom of page 3 at the actual 2018 income tax brackets for ordinary income for single and married couples filing a joint return. You see, the bottom of page 3 contrasts in the shaded boxes over on the left. Those are the inflation-adjusted brackets that would have been used for this year, 2018, because remember, every October, Treasury issues the upcoming brackets for the next year. So we already knew when this legislation passed what would have been the case if Congress had done nothing, which was wonderful because it gives us this direct apples-to-apples comparison. Had there not been the law, this is what the law was. But now that there's this new system, you can see for yourself what's going on. I'll give you a moment to ego surf the new chart because that's the first thing I did when I saw the brackets is, ooh, where am I now? Oh, 12%. I really need a wife that works. All right, well, anyway, so you can see for yourself we still have 7 brackets. Well, there's epic fail number 1. Remember when we were talking last year how Republican leadership wanted to consolidate the number of tax brackets from 7 down to 3 because 7 was way too complex. With 7 brackets, you had to both multiply and add. If we could get that down to 3 brackets, well, all you'd have to do is, well, multiply and add, but the point is you got 3 instead of 7, and that makes it simpler. It is monosyllabic. It doesn't require more than one hand. This is very appealing to Republican leadership. So we wanted to simplify, but we couldn't simplify. So we still have 7 brackets, but you'll notice, with one exception, that's the lowest bracket, they're all a little bit lower. Some of them are some big winners, but if you say everybody's a winner, not necessarily. Look, if you had a $300,000 taxable income as an unmarried person in 2018 under the old rules, you would be in the 33% bracket, but under the new rules, you're in the 35% bracket. But I'll be the first to concede. That's a misleading statement because while, yes, a taxable income of $300,000 under the new law puts you in a higher bracket than what was the case under the old law, the way you compute taxable income under the new law is so fundamentally different than the way that it was before. The real way to get an honest comparison is to assume the same gross income and the same expenses for the same taxpayer because previously deductible items now suddenly become non-deductible, and there's one or two new deduction provisions that are going to result in some massive savings for even modestly incomed individuals. So it's way too superficial to say, well, it looks like you're paying a little bit less tax. It depends entirely on what your gross income is and even what it's comprised of, as well as what expenditures you've made during the year. Then you could make an apples-to-apples comparison. But for right now, the fruit salad is a little bit mixed. Go to the top of page 4, and you will see that Congress did absolutely nothing with respect to the preferential rates that are applied to qualified dividend income and adjusted net capital gains. name. We even use, if you'll notice, roughly the same breakpoints that had been the case under old law. I'm not sure why the breakpoints are off by a couple of $100 between the old law and the new law, except to say maybe the people who were writing the new law misentered the information from the old law or rounded differently than did Treasury. But for whatever reason, they're just off by a couple $100. But the big bottom line lesson is the same 0, 15, and 20% rates apply. And yes, Virginia, we still have the 3.8% net investment income surcharge. Thanks, Obama. If we can ever repeal and replace Obamacare and build that wall and the other things that are consistent with the agenda, maybe we can get rid of the 3.8% surcharge. We thought it could happen under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Turned out that wasn't all that popular, and we needed every little Senate vote that we could get because, you know, we were getting to the point where we were going to have to put in a guy who was denied access to shopping malls to help him pass this legislation. So we couldn't do anything remotely controversial to get this little sucker passed. So we still have the 3.8% net investment income surcharge. Down at the bottom of page 4, you see one area in which Republican leadership feels they were successful in achieving simplification, and that is implementation of the so-called 0% bracket. While nominally the tax brackets begin at 10% on your first dollar of taxable income, you and I know that you can have a pretty significant amount of gross income and still have a taxable income of zero because of what under old law was the holy trinity of the standard deduction plus the personal exemptions and plus, for those of you that had fun on your Saturday nights, a child tax credit. Okay? Between having a standard deduction and personal exemptions that were given to you just by virtue of surviving the year, along with a child tax credit given to you for the commendation of surviving the year if you have children, you could have tens of thousands of dollars of gross income and still not pay any tax under the federal income tax. But from the Republican perspective, that was hella hard. Why do you have to have a standard deduction and personal exemptions and a child tax credit to achieve what is functionally a 0% bracket? So as originally conceived, we were going to get rid of personal exemptions, we were going to get rid of the child tax credit, and we were just going to give everybody a big, fattened up, foie gras stuffed standard deduction. If we could take your standard deduction and basically double it, that'll be good enough. Then many taxpayers won't even have to worry about itemizing deductions anymore, achieving some significant simplification. And you get rid of all this stuff with exemptions. Because remember, with exemptions, you get them not only for yourself, but you also get them for your dependents. And the tax code doesn't ask you, do you feel like you are providing the support for this leech that is staying on your couch well beyond their welcome? Do you feel that you are continuing to provide not only for your PhD-educated child, but also for their significant other who can't afford to get a full-time job because that interferes with their songwriting career that they have going on? They don't ask you how it really works. Instead, we have these mechanical tests of, do you have a qualifying child? It's not enough that you have a child. You can have a child that meets a 6-part test. My child flunks 5 out of 6 tests that are administered in the course of a week's time. I'm lucky he can be a qualifying child. Then, for other people, they have to be a qualifying relative. And go figure, there's a different 6-part test for them. Who needs all that? Just give yourself a big fat standard deduction, that's fine. And as originally conceived, why are we doing a child tax credit? Just give everybody a big fat standard deduction, you don't have to worry about it. That child tax credit is a problem. It's only $1,000, and it gets denied to you if you make too much income. You don't have to have a whole lot of taxable income or adjusted gross income, and your child tax credit gets phased out. Just give everybody a big fat standard deduction. Look at the bottom of page 4. Mission accomplished on the big fat standard deduction. It is nearly doubled. $24,000 for married couples, half that amount for single people, and a number midway in between for head of household, and same number for singles as for married filing separately. By the way, the original version of the bill got rid of head of household and got rid of married filing separately, which had some very clear policy implications to it, right? I mean, if you were married but filing a separate return, the message there was clear. If you don't trust your spouse enough to file a joint return because your spouse is a high school teacher dying of cancer and is making meth on the side, and you don't want to go down along with the business, put on your big kid pants and get a divorce, was the policy message that we were sending there. And if you were a head of household supporting multiple mouths with your own income, well, that's your fault. Do what the rest of us did. Get cable, put it in the bedroom, stop having kids. And then maybe we could do something about this, right? Well, for whatever reason, those didn't play well with focus groups. So we still have the head of household, we still have married filing separately, so we still have them at least for the time being. Go over to the bottom of page 5. We got rid of personal and dependency exemptions. Yes! We get rid of qualifying children. Well, we don't get rid of qualifying children, but we get rid of a 6-part test for qualifying children, a 6-part test for qualifying relatives. Ah, that's all in the rearview mirror. Thank you, Congress. But then, notice, top of page 5, we still have a child tax credit. In fact, notice, the child tax credit is even bigger and better than it was before. The hell? How'd that slip through? Well, conventional wisdom suggests that this is a nod to the First Lady. Because remember, the First Lady has this dual policy platform of anti-cyberbullying and pro-family. And the thinking is if we don't do something to like throw her a bone every once in a while, she's going to start blinking, indicating she's being held against her will. So if we want her playing along here, we got to do something. So let's have a child tax credit and let's make it even bigger. Check it out. Old child tax credit, $1,000. New child tax credit, $2,000 per child. These kids start to pay for themselves. If you buy generic brand cereal and ration them to 2 meals a day, you can make some money off your kids here. And then notice, as if that's not enough, we've added an additional $500 credit per dependent. By the way, we no longer call this the child tax credit. It has now been formally renamed the child and family tax credit, further sending the subliminal message that children really aren't a part of our families. We have to have a child and family tax credit that is in play. Now, how are we going to know somebody who's going to be a dependent? Easy, if they meet the test of a qualifying relative. And how do we know that somebody's going to be a child? Easy, if they meet the test of a qualifying child. Hold the phone, Sparky. I thought the whole idea is that we were going to get rid of this 6-part test because it was way too confusing. All we've done is cut and paste it and put it into the child tax credit. It's still there. It's just coming to you on a later line on the Form 1040 than it was before. That isn't simplification, it's relocation. And yet, we're patting ourselves on the back that we've really done something here. Notice that there's higher AGI thresholds now. Now look, you can have $200,000 of adjusted gross income before you start to lose out on that $2,000 per child tax credit. I don't know about you, but I know what I'm doing this weekend. That child tax credit is more attractive than it has ever been before. Hurry up and take advantage of it while you can. This expires in 2026, but by that time you can have them in prep school. So it works out and should be a fine little deal. Go to page 6. Let's talk about education expenses here really briefly. We're not going to highlight everything. The House bill had proposed a whole bunch of changes here. The House bill got rid of the deduction for qualified student loan interest. And the House bill got rid of the deduction, the above-the-line deduction for qualified tuition and related expenses. Senate bill said, that's a little too ambitious, don't you think? And we still have those. So notice what's not there is some stuff that was in the House bill that you may have heard about or that your clients might be familiar with. Probably about the only two things we need to talk about there is that first item, first under 529 plans. You can now use a tax-free 529 distribution to also provide for elementary and secondary school expenses, not just for college expenses. Tax-free distributions from 529 plan to pay for elementary or secondary education expenses. The only thing to keep in mind here is that the total amount that can be used per child in a calendar year, the total amount that can come out of all 529 plans in a single year for any particular child is $10,000 per child. Not $10,000 per 529 plan, $10,000 per child. So if I post a baby bump on Instagram and instantly maternal grandparents start a 529 plan and paternal grandparents do the same thing, we're talking $10,000 total out of both accounts, not $10,000 out of each. But I can use them for elementary and secondary schools. Doesn't matter if it's private or public. Doesn't matter if it is parochial or secular. You have that added flexibility and added benefit. That's kind of a nice thing. And the only other one that I kind of want to mention just out of a little bit of spite, pages 6 and 7, notice that there is this new excise tax that is imposed on private colleges and universities that is an excise tax of 1.4% of the university's net investment income from its endowment. Holy cow, we're going after private schools and their endowments. I say this as a product of all public schools, who has only taught at public law schools and who currently teaches at a public law school. But for those of you that went to private schools, don't necessarily be alarmed, because if you look at the details under the statute, the only private universities that are affected are those that have at least 500 full-time equivalent undergraduate students and whose endowment is large enough that the average endowment per student is more than $500,000. More than $500,000 per student. I've done the research on this. There are exactly 30 private colleges and universities in these United States that have endowments that are that large. Anybody know which one is number one? Harvard is not number one. Harvard is number three. Yale is number two. Stanford, you West Coast hippies. That's number four. Princeton. Yes, Princeton is the number one. Anybody here go to Princeton? All right, if you went and it was not on a full ride, you suck. Because their endowment is huge. So they were obviously doing you a favor to admit you if they made you pay to come in. I love this legislation because number 30 on that list, the one that has an average endowment of $511,000 per pupil, is our crosstown rival, Emory University. And so we just love to watch the hemorrhaging to their endowment and just hoping the money will trickle down to an urban law school. That's fun to dream about, but yeah, it will trickle down, I'm sure. Move over to page 7. Let's talk about some other individual deduction items. Next up on the list is the home mortgage interest deduction. It changed, yes, not as much as what the House bill had done, but yes, it's changed, so we should talk about it. Remember when you and I went to school and we learned about the home mortgage interest deduction, we learned that you could deduct interest on two forms of home mortgages. That was either those that qualified as acquisition indebtedness or those that were home equity indebtedness. And if you'll recall from the cobwebs of your mind, acquisition debt is debt that is taken out to buy, build, or improve a qualified residence. And the statute defined a qualified residence as your principal residence plus one other residence of your choice. So those of you that have more than two houses,
oh, you have such difficult choices to make.
Shall I include both the West Lynn home and the Lake Oswego home? Or is it about time that we take the Florence property into account here?
Oh, what am I to do? It's hard out here for a pimp.
You are limited to two houses, but for most of us who went to public school, yeah, we're fine. We're not going to have two houses in our lifetime, much less at the same time, so we're good to go. Remember, under the old rules, the maximum amount that you could treat as acquisition indebtedness was $1 million. So if I went to Lake Oswego and got a starter home that cost, say, $1.5 million, okay? If I take out $1.5 million loan from the bank under the old rules, I could only deduct 2/3 of the interest payment because I could only treat $1 million of the $1.5 million as acquisition indebtedness. But then we also had the deduction for home equity indebtedness, which a few years ago Treasury had said, yeah, you can treat another $100,000 of your $1.5 million mortgage as home equity debt. But the way it was originally conceived was that home equity debt applied to your HELOCs, your home equity line of credit that you would take out as a second mortgage on the home. Where again, if you remember, we didn't care how you used the debt. With acquisition debt, you had to use it toward the house. But with home equity in debt, you could use it to go on a second honeymoon. You could put the kids through school. You could put the kids through rehab. It didn't matter. All that we cared about was that the debt was secured by the house. And if the debt was secured by the house, you could treat up to $100,000 of your HELOC as home equity indebtedness, and you could deduct the interest on that amount. Well, new rule, says the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, a la Bill Maher. Starting in 2018, the maximum for acquisition indebtedness, for this is at least for new mortgages taken out as of the beginning of 2018, the new cap is now just $750,000. So under my same, if I got my $1.5 million mortgage today, as opposed to December of last year, instead of deducting two-thirds of the interest, I'm only going to be able to deduct half the interest because of the $750,000 cap that is in play. Good news, though, if you got your mortgage before 2018, even if that mortgage is more than $750,000, the old $1 million cap still applies to your mortgage going forward, even into 2018 and beyond. Even if you refinance that previously existing $1 million mortgage, it will still be treated as relating back to the date of the original mortgage, and you're good to go. But the bad news for everyone, old HELOCs and new HELOCs alike, no more deduction for home equity indebtedness at all. Phrased differently, the maximum amount that you can treat as home equity indebtedness has been reduced to zero. You don't get a deduction for home equity debt anymore going forward. And remember, this is only through 2025 because all the individual, all the carbon-based taxpayers only see the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in effect through 2025. Then we go back to the good old days of 2017. Okay? It's corporations that get the long-term permanent benefits, but more on that coming up there in a little bit. Go to page 8. Of course, the one that got a whole lot of headlines, particularly in blue states, is the new limitation on your maximum deduction for personal, state, and local income and sales and property taxes. In case any of you are working with Washington clients and sales tax is still an issue. But you know that normally as an Oregonian, you get to deduct your property taxes and your income taxes against your federal return. New rule, maximum amount that you can deduct there, at least with respect to personal use property, is $10,000. There's a hypothetical in the materials there that explains how those limitations work. Remember that when I talk about real property taxes on investment property or on business use property, I still get to deduct those in full because the limitation on $10,000 only applies to the deduction under Section 164 for personal use property. So as long as my income tax liability and property tax liability on my home combined is less than 10 grand, I'm not impacted. But for many of you and for your clients, it is more than 10 grand for both of those, and that limitation is going to come into play. Of course, there's the talk now about, well, can we craft a donation that you can make to the Salem Fund that you can claim as a charitable contribution to try to itemize in addition to the $10,000 that's there. And that's a wonderful little pipe dream, but for those of us that went to school and learned about substance over form and sham transactions and economic substance, we're at least skeptical, pending what some other states may do. So let them be Joan of Arc, let them win or lose, and we can maybe mimic what they're doing a little bit later. Charitable contributions came out not so bad on pages 8 and 9, as you see. Cash contributions now, instead of being limited to 50% of your AGI, get limited to 60% of your AGI, so that's kind of nice. Doesn't apply to marketable securities, doesn't apply to contributions of long-term capital gain property, but cash is treated better, again, for a limited time only. So much of this legislation is like the McRib, people. You got to hurry up and take advantage of it while it's there, because come the end of February, it's off the menu. And why do I even know that? Disturbing. The other thing that you see at the top of page 9, sorry, Duck fans who are making inordinate contributions to be able to get your season tickets down there to Autzen, the old rule allowed you to deduct 80% of your season tickets as a charitable contribution. Perhaps because we recognize that when you pay season tickets, some of it is really going just to the school and not necessarily to the football program. I mean, after all, the school does have to hire the tutors that will actually take the examinations on behalf of the athletes. So there are costs that are associated to the universities from having these programs. So really, since these are very expensive tickets, shouldn't I be able to deduct some of it? The answer, of course, classically is, hell no. You only get a charitable contribution to the extent what you pay exceeds the ticket price and what they charge you. Old law allowed you to deduct 80% of the stated ticket price. Complete and total boondoggle. We've gotten rid of that now. So now you're actually going to have to pony up and make a real contribution. You're going to have to give Uncle Phil a run for his money and get some things named after you so that he'll pump in even more money and raise your facility and put up a new one in his name. So go ahead and deal with that. Medical expenses, middle of page 9. The House bill had gotten rid of medical expense deductions entirely. The Senate bill rescued it, and notice, reinstated the old 7.5% of adjusted gross income threshold. Remember, for the past few years now, we've had you don't get to deduct medical expenses unless they exceed 10% of your AGI. And for a while, we had a transition rule for old sick people that they could still use the 7.5% limitation. Well, that's over with now. Everybody was playing with 10. The Senate bill says for 2017, this is one of the few provisions that related back to 2017, for 2017 and 2018 only, you still get the 7.5% threshold. So more of your medical expenses will be deductible than what was the case under prior law. But that's only for 2017 and 2018 returns. Come 2019, we still have a medical expense deduction, but everybody's put on the 10% threshold instead of 7.5%. Oh my gosh, they changed the rules for alimony. Half of you in this room have jaws hitting the desk, right? They're changing the rules for alimony. What's up with this? Well, if you're thinking about getting divorced, or, you know, if you want to tell your spouse if they're thinking about getting divorced, this could be the time to act, because come 2019, the rules are changing. The way we know it now is that if a cash payment from an ex from, you know, the earning spouse to the evil spouse, I'm sorry, the payee spouse, that is normally deductible by the payor and includable in the payee's gross income. Section 71B for the inclusion, 215 for the deduction. Come 2019, effectively, those sections disappear. Alimony payments are not income to the recipient, nor are they deductible by the payor. That's only for divorce and separation agreements that are entered into as of January 1, 2019 and forward. So if you want the old rules to apply, hurry up and get divorced. If you want to hurry up and get divorced, but you would kind of like the 2019 rules to apply to you, the law allows you to be able to opt in early if you would like, and by the agreement of both spouses. So you can have your divorce and the tax consequences that you want at the same time. 2018 could be your banner year if you take advantage of it there and do it right. Okay. Page 10, we're limiting casualty and theft losses only now to presidentially declared casualties. Apparently, you don't have to have a presidentially declared theft, but you have to have a presidentially declared casualty, which means in the new administration, we're talking about only casualties that are huge, massive, amazing, terrific. You've never seen casualties like these. These are going to blow your mind. You're going to love these casualties. So only those will now qualify. Holy cow, we got rid of all miscellaneous itemized deductions. Remember the old rule? If you had a miscellaneous itemized deduction, you could only get them to the extent in the aggregate they exceeded 2% of adjusted gross income. We called it the 2% haircut. Well, now it's the 100% decapitation. Because you don't get a deduction for miscellaneous itemized deductions at all. And you see examples of some of the things that are on there, like your safe deposit box rental and your hobby losses and appraisals for charitable contributions. If you're doing one of those conservation easement contributions and you pay significantly for some good appraisals. Normally, those were miscellaneous itemized deductions. Yet, no more, no deduction for them whatsoever. Tax advice. Remember how we could always say that our fees were deductible, but our colleagues who did other things, they were not? And the clients would be like, why? And we'd be like, because we wrote the statute. And we could give ourselves the competitive advantage to do that. That competitive advantage is now lost. The biggest one, though, no more deductions for unreimbursed employee business expenses. If I go to work at Taco Bell in the summer, because I'm not going to do research, If I go work at Taco Bell in the summer, they make me buy a polo shirt that says Live Mas up in the corner. And they make me pay for it. It's 30 bucks. It's a special kind of material because it has to ward off that stuff that's 37% beef, which is a hard stain to get out of regular cloth. So I get this super slick polo shirt that says Live Mas. I don't get a deduction for it at all now because I'm an employee. Under the old rules, well, it was a miscellaneous itemized deduction, but good news, I worked at Taco Bell. 2% of my AGI was less than the $30 shirt. So I was going to get some kind of deduction for it, but now I was hosed. Remember the people who were especially hard hit by this until the Bush tax cuts came around? That was teachers, elementary and secondary school teachers. According to an article that I read here at the beginning of the year, the average expenditure made by teachers, elementary and secondary school teachers in these United States in a calendar year period, you won't believe this, is over $3,000 per educator. They're spending over $3,000 on average out of their own pocket to provide for supplies in their classrooms that can't be furnished for them. Okay? Now, example, Mrs. Johnson throws a Hunger Games theme party at the end of the year. She's going to lock all of her students in the gym, give them all a pair of scissors, and the four that make it out alive get to go to the next grade. Okay? It's been a hard year. She's had 30 just like your a-hole that you're shipping off to her for 8 hours a day. So have some sympathy. Anyway, she, you know, little Timmy and little Susie in the class come from households where they can't afford to send their kid to school with scissors, not even the little green left-handed 10 for a buck scissors at Walmart. So Mrs. Johnson, she loves an underdog. She goes to Office Max and she buys the sharpest, longest scissors that she can find. She holds on to the receipt. She takes them to her principal and says, reimburse me. And the principal's like, yeah, you tried that before. We don't do that here. Well, it was a miscellaneous itemized deduction. And after a while, we started realizing, well, you know, even 2% of a teacher's income is still something. And so teachers were kind of taking it in the shorts that way. And we thought, well, that's not right. A great philosopher once said, I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Anyway, we love teachers. Teachers are great. They're fantastic. We should reward our teachers. Our teachers are heroes. What can we do to help teachers? Well, we could pay them more. No, really, what? Well, all right, if we're not going to pay them more, how about this? And remember the Bush tax cuts did this? They said, instead of making it a miscellaneous itemized deduction, let's make it an above-the-line deduction for elementary and secondary school teachers only. But two important limits. One, we're going to limit it to $500 per educator because we don't want this to just be a license to go invade Office Max. Okay? You know how every teacher has an Office Max fetish? Like, you know, every August they're like, ooh, it's a special day. They wake up at 5 a.m. like it's Black Friday all over again to go get their little highlighters for the day. Only anal people in the room got that along with me, but that's all right. So 500 is the max deduction. The other big limit, of course, is that we will not allow a deduction for non-athletic supplies used in health or PE courses. I confess when that came out in the statute, I was like, what the hell is that? So I dug into the legislative history. You know what they're getting at with that language? Condoms. We don't want Mrs. Letourneau to get a deduction for giving a condom to Billy, right? But you want to go buy scissors? All day long, sister. You can deduct that, but certainly not condoms. That's irresponsible. Whatever. Good news, the above-the-line deduction for teachers still continues. But for every other employee, gone. No more miscellaneous itemized deductions whatsoever. Thank God, bottom of page 10, we got rid of that qualified bicycle commuting expense reimbursement, right? Weren't you tired of people having their employers buying them those bike shorts that were three sizes too small? And then you have to look at them as you're driving your car. There's just way too many bikes out there. You're hitting them. They got their own special lanes in this city, for God's sakes. We need to do something to curb that bike population. It's about time that we got the testicular fortitude to do something about that with our tax laws. So that's good. All right, page 11. We have changed how we compute kiddie tax liability. We still have the kiddie tax. So if you shuffle some of your investment portfolio to your four-year-old with the thinking of this keeps it in the family, but they're in a nice low bracket, so we'll pay less tax, there's still the kiddie tax. But remember how it worked under the old days? That kid's net investment income was taxed at your marginal rate. Under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, new rule, the kids are treated like a trust or estate. And the trust and estate tax brackets apply to their net unearned income. Ooh, right? All of a sudden, you're into the 37% bracket once you have taxable income in excess of $12,500, even if the parent is not. Because under the kiddie tax rules, we're just going to treat the unearned income as if it was earned by a separate trust and apply the trust tax brackets to that. Going to be interesting to see how that works out. Go to page 12, if you would please, next, because next up on the hit parade, we get to the thing that this was all really about, and that was business tax reform. And in particular, the stuff that's on page 12, and that was reducing the rate applicable to C corporations. In the middle of page 12, you see the old tax brackets that used to apply to C corporations from 15 to 35%. Those were the days. As of 2018, all C corporation taxable income is taxed at a flat rate of 21%. Why 21%? Well, originally, the president had wanted 15%, but then the deficit numbers were just staggering. And so then they said, how about 20%? And 20% was the number that we kept using. But when we were doing preliminary estimates on how much it was going to cost to reduce the C corporation rate that way, it looked like it was going to add about $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the course of the next 10 years. So if you'll recall, in October, special budget resolutions were passed in both chambers that said, we will treat this tax reform legislation as revenue neutral as long as the total 10-year deficit does not exceed $1.5 trillion. It's revenue neutral if we come within $1.5 trillion. I'm trying to negotiate a similar package in our household budget, but I'm finding it thus far unsuccessful. Because my wife understands cash flow and what it means to be revenue neutral. So that was good enough. But the problem was, in order to implement this and everything else, we were going just a hair over that $1.5 trillion. So run the numbers if we did 21%. We run the numbers at 21%. It comes in just under $1.5 trillion. Sold, 21% it is. So we have a 21% rate because that's how you make sausage. Not because anybody thinks that 21% is the magical number that will provide stimulus and everything. It was the thing to make the numbers work according to the voodoo dolls that do all of this guessing that tell us how all of this is going to impact our behavior as a result of these new laws coming into play. No offense to the economists in the rooms, but you're all busy assuming things that aren't real anyway, so you're not listening. All right. So, with a new significantly lower tax rate on C corporation income, page 13 of the materials suggests some things that a baker's dozen of pointy-headed academics wrote an article that got picked up by, I think it was the New York Times, and thus got all tens of thousands of downloads, shattered all of the records, and finally caused people to think maybe download count should not be the basis of summer stipend. Yes, hallelujah. By the way, you can download this paper if you'd like to and help tour. I got two kids. So if you want, let me know. I'll give you the link. You can go just download it from all of your computers at home. As long as they have separate IP addresses, we're good to go. It's all nice and legitimate, and we game the system fairly. Anyway, this baker's dozen of academics said, in light of a 21% rate, what are the games that people are going to play now? And as you see, they talk about how people will form C corporations to hold on to investment income. I'm not so sure about that. We still have the personal holding company tax rules that are in the code. It just means they're going to have new life now. We still have the accumulated earnings tax. We still have the 3.8% net investment income surcharge, because if and when you finally do make a distribution from your piggy bank C corporation to you, it will be treated as a dividend, which could be subject to that 3.8%. So, I'm not so sure people are going to form C corporations just to hold their investment assets. Middle of page 13 says, well, maybe people will form a C corporation for labor income. Don't pay Sam Donaldson, pay Sam Donaldson, Inc., because then that way the income can just be taxed at 21% and I can defer a subsequent payment going forward. But again, we have accumulated earnings tax. We have other corporate rules that suggest that that may not necessarily be the right idea. The one piece of advice that I think does make some sense, though, here in the middle of page 13, remember the old rule that if you had somebody who was a shareholder employee of a C corporation The old mantra was to say, pay that employee generous compensation and pay them little to nothing in dividends. And the reason why we use that old mantra was because compensation is deductible by the C corporation, but dividend distributions are not. So if you wanted to mitigate the double tax, why not pay the income of the C corporation to the shareholder employee in the form of compensation? Because even though it is compensation, which will be taxed at a higher bracket to the shareholder than would be a dividend, and even though as compensation you're going to pay employment taxes, you were paying no corporate income tax on those dollars at all. And the corporate income tax bite was bigger than the combined difference to the employee by treating it as ordinary income and subjecting it to employment taxes. So we always knew, pay generous compensation and be very frugal with dividends. But now, in a 21% rate environment, when you run the numbers under many but not all assumptions, oftentimes that conventional wisdom ends up being wrong. And the right answer is to pay a dividend distribution, even though it is non-deductible, because by the time you subject compensation income to a 37% rate and employment taxes, you're better off having a non-deductible payment by the corporation subjecting more of its income to a 21% rate, even and then getting a preferential rate on the dividend distribution going out to the shareholder. So it might well be that with your closely held C corporation clients out there, challenging those old assumptions about how much compensation they're receiving might prove of some value and is at least something where somebody needs to be running the numbers there to see what works. Can we go to page 14, though, and talk about the thing that everybody's kind of talking about with this new bill, at least in terms of the treatment of business income? We're reducing the rates for C corporations down to 21%. That's great for publicly traded entities that are C corporations. But for most of your closely held business clients out there, they're not operating as C corporations because they came and talked to you. And you told them that they should do a pass-through entity. They should be an S corporation, or even better yet, they should be a partnership, or even better than that, they should be an LLC. And for the clients who refused to follow your advice, they remained as sole proprietors. What are we doing for all of those people? S shareholders, partners in partnerships, and sole proprietors. As you see, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act enacts new Section 199 Cap A. And for the CPAs in the room, you'll be pleased to know we got rid of Section 199, the deduction for domestic production activities income and all the necessary hell that went along with that, and we've replaced it with the new and improved and simplified 199 Cap A. Whether this is simplification or not, I invite you to consider. What I do here on the next couple pages of the outline is to give you an executive summary. That is something that you can share with clients about here's what you need to know about this new legislation. And then a few pages after that, you see a heading that's called Under the Hood Look at the New 199A Deduction. For the next 7 or 8 pages, there's a more detailed discussion of all of the concepts and terms, as well as a couple of examples pulled from the conference report and a few other things to help you understand the nitty-gritty details of this deduction. For our purpose, though, let's make sure we're all in agreement, big picture, about what this deduction means. First off, who qualifies for the deduction, as explained in the materials there under the executive summary? You have to be a partner in a partnership, a shareholder in an S corporation, or a sole proprietor. People who are ineligible for this are C corporation shareholders and employees. Planning tip number one, quit your job. If you work for the man, you're not going to get a deduction. But if you work for yourself, you're going to get a deduction. As I was taking Lyft from the hotel this afternoon over here, it dawned on me, I'm not going to get a qualified business income deduction. My Lyft driver is. Right? Why? Well, because my Lyft driver is providing a valuable service. I'm making more lawyers. Right? He's shipping us around from place to place. Right? He's going to get a 20% deduction. I'm not going to because he's self-employed and I'm a mere employee. So, you know, from now on, any other tax advice I'm giving in this session should be discounted to reflect that reality, that I continue to be a moron who has a steady job. Anyway, what's not explained in the materials, and I don't think I explained it very well in this draft that I prepared, so I'm going to see if this maybe works out a little bit better. There's one dollar number that you have to take into account. And that $1 number is $157,500. $157,500. That's a magic number, okay? That's the number that applies if you're unmarried. If you're married, you each get one of those, so the number that you want to focus on is double that, $315,000. $157,500 or $315,000. That's the number you need to focus on. Why? If your taxable income, without regard to this new deduction, so if your taxable income, gross income minus all of your deductions except for this new deduction, is less than that magic number, then generally speaking, you're going to be able to get a full deduction under this new 199 Cap A. Okay? If your taxable income is less than $50,000 more than the magic number, your deduction is likely to be reduced, but it won't be full-on disallowed. And if your taxable income is more than $50,000 more than the magic number, then two things happen. One, your deduction could be lost entirely, depending upon the type of business in which you're engaged. And even if you still get a deduction, your deduction is going to be the lesser of 20% of your business income, or generally speaking, half of the W-2 wages that your business pays. Whereas PoFolk get a full deduction of 20% of their business income regardless of their business activity, as long as they're an S-Corp shareholder, a partner, or a sole proprietor. Okay? I think that's about the easiest way to explain generally what's happening there and why you need to pay attention to that one particular number. And those schedules that are given there in the materials is an attempt to put into schedule form how exactly all of that shakes out. But big picture, that's what's going on there. Now, when I say if your taxable income is more than the magic number, there are limits that apply depending upon the type of business. Look at the paragraph there under specified service businesses. If your business is involved in the performance of services in the fields of health, law, accounting, actuarial science, performing arts, consulting, athletics, financial services, or brokerage services, you may be disallowed entirely. What is it that doctors, lawyers, accountants, actuaries, actors, and athletes all have in common? No, they are hot. They're the sexy people. This is a good-looking person's tax, right? If you're too good-looking, you don't need a deduction, right? So the 199A deduction is for trolls who aren't in the business of good-looking people. Actually, you're right. Yes, it's service intensive, but it's more than that. Look at paragraph 2. All of those have as their principal asset the reputation or skill of one or more of its employees or owners. So if your business is about who you are, okay, then if your taxable income exceeds a certain threshold, you may not get a deduction at all. The Lyft driver gets a deduction, but the gigolo that sits in the back and goes from trick to trick, because your business is all about your reputation. Trust me. The sweater vest pulls double duty, my friends. Okay, that's just gross. Sorry. Anyway, if it's a goodwill focused or the service focused business, then you could be SOL, statute of limitations, and shut out of being able to use this. Notice next, you have to be engaged in a U.S. trader business. So if I'm going to be a Venezuelan gigolo but keep my tax prof in the United States dual life thing going, I don't get the deduction for my activities in Venezuela. If I'm an American doing business abroad, I'm only getting this for my American business income, because this is what we're trying to make great again. We're not trying to make Latin America great again. We're trying to keep them the hell out. All right. Now, you get the deduction for, but we'll take their drugs. You get your deduction for generally 20% of qualified business income. As you see, qualified business income is effectively your net ordinary income from that trade or business. So your net ordinary income, if your business has any capital gains or dividends, that's taken out. You're not going to get a 20% deduction for that. You're getting it for the net ordinary income. And as explained in the materials, if your total net income from all of your businesses is a negative, then you don't get a deduction because you already suck. But that net loss will carry over to next year as a separate trade or business activity that sucked that bad next year. And you can offset your income from your businesses the next year against that loss. So if you have a net loss, you don't get a deduction, but the net loss carries over. If you have net income, generally speaking, your deduction starts at 20% of your qualified business income. Unless you're over the magic number and more than $50,000 over the magic number, in which case your deduction is the lesser of your qualified 20% of your qualified business income, or 50% of the W-2 wages that are paid to all employees of your business, including yourself. Okay. Now, imagine the entrepreneur who, whether through sole proprietorships or LLCs or through S corporations, is a real estate magnate and has made his wealth and his brand through the acquisition of real estate. You don't need a whole lot of W-2 employees to run that business. If the deduction is the lesser of 20% of your net ordinary income or 50% of your W-2 wages, you might start to say, wait a minute, I'm going to get hosed here. And new rule, if you're a real estate tycoon, the rules will be written in your favor. So we have a choice. You either get 50% of your W-2 wages, or if you don't pay a whole lot of W-2 wages, the formula instead is, you won't believe this, 25% of your W-2 wages plus 2.5% of the unadjusted basis of all depreciable property used in your business. Now unpack that, kids. 2.5% of your unadjusted, your original cost basis in all of your depreciable property, real and tangible, as long as that property is still in the hands of your business at the close of the calendar year and has not exceeded its useful life. And by the way, we're going to define useful life to mean useful life plus 10 more years. Your unadjusted original cost basis. I buy a building for $1 million, even though I'm depreciating that sucker over, what, 39 years or whatever, I still get to use 2.5% of that $1 million original cost basis. Not a bad business if you can get into it. Okay? Now remember, your deduction is the lesser of 20% of your qualified business income, or 50% of your W-2 wages, or 25% of your W-2 wages plus 2.5%. You get the bigger of those two to compare against your 20% of qualified business income deduction. So, again, the simplification just oozes here, does it not? Now, interestingly, you get the 199A deduction in addition to the standard deduction. So the qualified business income deduction has become the new personal exemption. Because remember how you got personal exemptions in addition to the standard deduction? Now you're going to get the qualified business deduction in addition to the standard deduction, or in addition to itemized deductions if you itemize. It is not, however, an above-the-line deduction, so it does nothing to affect your adjusted gross income. It only serves to affect your taxable income to the extent that you are able to claim it. Two last little observations as you see from the executive summary. First, yes, this applies to trusts and estates that are partners in partnerships or that are S corporation shareholders. And the statute recognizes then that that might present some issues, all of what you heard from the presentation before about how are we going to share this deduction between the trust or the estate as a separate entity and the beneficiaries. And effectively, the statute says, we'll let regulations prescribed by the secretary handle all of that. So at least Congress was aware enough to know, hey, that's kind of an issue, isn't it? Well, we'll have them figure it out.
Yep.
Okay. Let's just go ahead and pass this legislation. Okay? Ready, fire, aim, and we're good to go. Last observation, sunrise, sunset. It's available in 2018. It expires at the end of 2025, absent some motivation to keep it going or to somehow extend it, if not altogether, make the little sucker permanent. So, in light of having that, You see some discussion that begins on page 19 of the materials. Page 19 of the materials. It says, how are people going to play games with this new rule? Well, if I am a partner in a law firm and I happen to be making a fair amount of money such that I'm north of that magic number, I say, uh-oh, it looks like I don't get a 20% deduction in connection with my law firm fees. But if my law firm also owns the building in which we operate, perhaps it makes a lot of sense to do this technique that's described over on page 20, and that is to break out, distribute out the real estate into a separate entity and have the law firm make payments of rent to the new entity. And until some regulations come out that will likely cast aspersions on this, perhaps pay generous rent to that LLC. Because if the LLC is engaged in a real estate activity that is not a specified service business, then all of that rental income can flow through to the owners of that LLC and be eligible for the 20% deduction. So take your sub-businesses that are all within the prohibited specified service business and do what they call here cracking. And that is crack the business and break it up into smaller businesses so that only a minimal amount of income is running through the service business and as much as you can runs through those other collateral businesses that can qualify. Now again, one might expect, and just 2 days ago when Treasury updated its priority guidance plan, remember its little regulations wish list, it has now added 18 new items to the list of regs that they want to implement by summer. I guess it's good to have goals, right? You know, like, sure, and I'll lose 30 pounds. The hell, why not? My annual resolution every year is to give up smoking because I've never started and I always feel like a winner. But, right, they've added 18 new ones, and one of the 18 new ones is we got to issue regs under this 199 cap A thing. Because you get the sense that already they're starting to think there's some things people can do with this. There's even the idea here of packing other qualifying businesses into the service partnership so that you can turn it into a multi-aspect business. You can make it into like a Fred Meyer-like business of not only do we do services, but we also do these other things as well so that you can dilute the portion of it that is relevant to services. And perhaps through the packing technique, it could be something that would work. Page 22 talks about the curious fact. If you are wondering why are we targeting the service industry and service businesses here, the big allergy that's going on about giving a 20% deduction to doctors and to lawyers and to accountants is that effectively you would be giving them a 20% deduction on their compensation, which employees would not be getting. Okay, because remember, this is not available to employees. And when you are a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, your fees are effectively your compensation for services. Why should you get a 20% deduction for your compensation if employees aren't going to get a 20% deduction for their compensation? So whether you like the result or where they set the number or whatever, at least you can understand the argument for why we disqualify service businesses. What I can't explain to you and have no basis to explain other than the possible presence of a powerful lobby is that there are at least two other code sections that contain this very same laundry list of health, law, accounting, actuarial services, athletes, financial services, everything else. Those other two sections are Section 1202 stock, qualified small business stock, where we disallow the benefit there. And also when we have the rules about who can use the cash method of accounting. And we generally say that unless you're a really small fry, if you're engaged in one of those businesses, you can't use the cash method of accounting. Okay? In both of those other code sections, though, the list also includes architects and engineers. This statute does not include architects and engineers among the individuals that are disqualified. So architects and engineers will get a 20% deduction for their fees that come to them for their compensation, even though arguably their business is as much about their goodwill and about the personal skills and reputation of the ones that are involved in their trade, just like all of the others. But for whatever reason, it was a great day to be an architect or engineer. So you see the suggestion on page 22. If you have a client who's an architect or engineer, see about moving your practice so you become an in-house member of their outfit. Lawyers, we have a problem with that because of our rules about sharing legal fees with non-lawyers. But those of you that aren't lawyers, or for lawyers who don't really give a damn about your license, this can be a nice way to go about getting yourself that 20% deduction that otherwise might not be available to you. So you see some other suggestions that are given there. Let's go on to page 24, though, 24 in the materials. We should talk about this new revolutionary expensing of depreciable property. I hope nobody else drank out of this glass. We'll find out in a few minutes. Remember how the old depreciation rules used to work? Suppose I bought a photocopier for use in my business. I couldn't deduct the cost up front, right? Because we learned that, well, since you're going to use that copier for a few years, you recover the cost over its useful life so you get a more accurate reflection of true income, match the income against the expenses of that copier over its useful life. We all grew up learning that. It was good, it was well. But then we started twisting that system in order to encourage consumers to purchase durable goods. And we had, for example, on page 24, the Section 179 election. When it was originally introduced in the late 70s, you could deduct up to $2,000 of the cost of depreciable property up front, no questions asked. And at the time, it was the late 70s. You know, we didn't have shirts with buttons above here. And, you know, we thought shag carpeting was cool. So it wasn't hard to impress us. We looked at a free $2,000 deduction, and we went, that's awesome. I love that. Sign me up for that. I want to do one of those things. Over time, that deduction has had to get bigger, better, fatter. We previously left off with up to $500,000 under the new rule. You automatically expense the first $1 million of depreciable property that you use in your business. For many of your clients, they're not going to depreciate assets anymore. They can just 179 it and be done with it. But even if you bought, you know, not just a photocopier, but like the photocopier. You bought the $1.5 million photocopier. I mean, this one will make copies of your butt without you even removing your pants because it's got an infrared sensor, right? Okay, it's a photocopier and four toner cartridges. Okay? That's about $1.5 million. So you got the $1.5 million photocopier. Well, $1 million only gets me so far. Oh my goodness, look at the bottom of page 24 and at the chart at the top of page 25. Section 168K is the ultimate infomercial provision of the code because it says after you've done your 179 bonus, but wait, there's more. Because as long as this property doesn't have a useful life in excess of 20 years, we'll let you deduct what used to be an additional 50% of your remaining basis. But check it out there, Florida, for 2018 to 2022, we've increased that to 100%. Of the remaining basis. Depreciation. That is so 2000 and late. Okay? Effectively, for the next 5 years, everyone is on the cash method of accounting when it comes to the purchase of capital assets. Everyone's on the cash method of accounting. You just expense it, no matter what, no questions asked. Remember the thinking here. If we get people out there buying durable goods, that's good for GDP, GNP, LOL, OMG. We got to do what we can to spur that investment. And the idea is that, you know, now that we're in a flourishing stock market, we'll have the funds to be able to go out and take wild advantage of this. Okay? You might want to check out, if you made your money through carried interest on pages 26 and 27, they try to scare you into thinking it's not a good deal anymore, to shut it down by having a 3-year holding period, but then you rightly snort at that because that's not going to change anything at all. But it looks like we've solved the carried interest problem. So for those that are concerned about that, that's well and good. But let's talk about something that's going to affect more of your clients. Page 27, like-kind exchanges. Remember those? Now you can only do like-kind exchanges with real property. No more car for car, computer for computer, sweater vest for sweater vest. Not allowed anymore. Just land for land. We'll excuse any transaction that was started in 2017 and finishes this year, but otherwise, it's limited only to real estate going forward. Check it out at the bottom of page 27 if you wonder why the jokes aren't as funny anymore. I want to make sure you get a full deduction for coming here. If this constituted entertainment under the new rules, you don't get a deduction at all for entertainment expenses. You only get deductions for business expenses. So I'm playing it all on the serious now, because I don't want there to be an allegation that any of you are going to lose any deductions as a result of this. Page 28, I hope this affects neither you nor your clients, but we have a new section 162Q that has some awfully weird wording. This is the Harvey Weinstein amendment to the code because it provides no deduction. As you see, this is the full text of the statute, shall be allowed under this chapter. For one, any settlement or payment related to sexual harassment or sexual abuse, if such settlement or payment is subject to a non-disclosure agreement. Or two, attorney's fees related to such a settlement or payment. Now, I understand Q1. If I have a client who makes a payment in a sexual harassment or sexual abuse claim and there's an NDA, there's no deduction for the payment that is being made to the victim for that if there's an NDA that's involved. Get it. But Q2 says you get no deduction for attorney's fees related to such a settlement or payment. And here's what I don't know. What does the such refer to? Does the such refer to any payment that is made in a case of sexual harassment or sexual abuse? Or is it only in cases of sexual harassment or sexual abuse where there's a non-disclosure agreement? The wording about the NDAs appears only in Q1. It doesn't appear in Q2. If Congress wanted to make it clear that you only lose the deduction for attorney's fees if there's an NDA involved, they would have used that same language in Q1 or Q2, or they would have moved that NDA language to the prologue before Q1 and Q2. But instead, the NDA stuff is only in Q1 and not in Q2, suggesting that there will be a broader denial of attorney's fees in those cases than there is. You could have a client who makes a payment to a victim of sexual abuse or sexual harassment, and as long as there's not an NDA there, that payment is fully deductible, but the attorney's fees are not? That doesn't seem quite right, and yet that is a permissible way to read that statute. So we'll have to assume Treasury's going to let us know how that goes. Notice finally at the bottom of page 28 and the top of page 29, Employee Achievement Award. Remember Employee Achievement Awards? This is the token that you give that it's an employee achievement award if it is an award of tangible personal property that is made in recognition of length of service or achievement in safety. So the prototypical example of the employee achievement award is the gold watch at retirement, right? The House bill called for eliminating that exclusion. We got to go after those gold watches. That's a big tax dodge. We got to shut that down. Carried interest can continue because we don't understand it. But a gold watch, damn it, that ought to be taxable. Okay? The House bill was all over that. And the Senate, most of them having received gold watches at some point early in their years before they joined the Senate, said, whoa, 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 we don't want that to be the case. People were alarmed under the House bill, though. Wait a minute, you get rid of the Employee Achievement Award. What are you doing about the holiday ham that you receive from your employer every December, which is especially good for morale if you're a vegan Jew? Am I now going to have to pay tax on that holiday ham? No, 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 that's a de minimis fringe. That's still excluded. Everything is still fine there. The only thing, notice, that the Act did was to clarify what is meant by tangible personal property. We put an end to giving gift cards as a way of recognizing length of service. Thanks for being with us for 40 years, and in your retirement, we all chipped in and we got you a $5 Starbucks card. All right? Well, now that's going to be $5 of gross income, so don't get a grande. In effect, is the lesson that we get from there. All of that and more awaits, but we have bigger matters in front of us, namely an open bar. Thanks very much for your patience. Hope to see you again sometime.